Okay. Good morning, everyone. I am Kamala Rampasad de Silva, Chief Executive Officer of the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute. It is my pleasure this morning to welcome you to our 1 hour session on part two of the business response to COVID-19. When we first held a session last week on April 19th, there were just about 226,000 people who were infected with COVID-19. Today, March 26th, the number has increased to 488,397, with the death toll climbing from 9,285 globally to 22,067. Thankfully, we see that more than 117,000 people have recovered from the coronavirus. While the medical community has been preparing for many years for the likelihood of another flu epidemic, having battled the swine flu, H1N1, and Ebola, still the outbreak of the coronavirus has taken the world by surprise. So today we are in a pandemic and everyone is trying to follow the WHO guidelines to flatten the curve and reduce the spread of COVID-19. To stem the spread, many countries have closed their borders. Today, we need to discuss the implications of the current fight and to determine how we can support our businesses to continue with economic activity, even while paying heed to the need of employees to be protected from infection. I would like to remind everyone of a recent quote from Omar Hassan writing in The Independent. Just as important as fighting the virus, if not more important, he says, is vaccinating our economies against the incoming pandemic of panic. Human suffering can come in the form of illness and death, but it can also be experienced as not being able to pay the bills or losing your home. Before I hand over to the panel, I want to remind everyone that we are not sending a message to boards to take over the management role. I wish to emphasize that boards are intended to provide support to their management team in times of crisis. COVID-19 is a global crisis. It has affected not just our health, but our supply chain and our businesses. So life is not normal. We have been encouraged to practice social distancing and do what we can to flatten the curve. Boards need to understand the implication of this for their management team and know how to provide guidance. While no one is an expert in this unprecedented situation, looking at responses from different countries can help us review and understand ways moving forward. So as we are navigating uncharted territory, the CCGI has taken this initiative to bring together persons from the region to discuss how we can provide guidance and assistance to each other as we respond as effectively as we can to the challenges. So our panel today will comprise of former chairman of the CCGI and attorney at law, Mr. Ronnie Bisessa, Executive Director of the Barbados International Business Association, Kamel Haynes, Procurement Specialist from the World Bank located in Guyana, Mr. Robbie Rambaran. We also intend to be joined by Mr. Lloyd Distant, who is the President of the Jamaica Chamber of Commerce. Unfortunately, I have not heard from Mr. Distant this morning, so I'm not sure if he or one of his executive management team from the Jamaica Chamber will be able to join us today. A final housekeeping note before we go though, please keep your microphones on mute. The panel will speak first and then the floor will be opened by the moderator for questions and contributions. There's an icon at the bottom of your screen to raise your hand, or you may text your messages in the chat icon and we will review it. Finally, just to let everyone know, this session is being recorded and will be made available on our website to anyone who would like to review it later. So I will now like to hand over to our panel moderator today, Chairman of the Caribbean Corporate Governance Institute, Mr. Nigel Romano. Over to you, Nigel.
Thank you, Kamla. Good morning. We are really faced with an unprecedented situation in the form of this global pandemic. This morning, the jobless claims in the U.S. were 3.28 million. To put that in context, at the height of the 2008 crisis, the jobless claims were about 700,000. This is global, this is unprecedented, and I believe that the focus of most governments across the globe right now is to mitigate the risk to economic activity as a result of isolation, social distancing. We have a number of, in Trinidad and Tobago, and I suspect in Barbados and Jamaica and Guyana and other countries across the region, governments are putting legislative frameworks in place and economic mitigants to help their citizens to navigate through this problem as we work to flatten the curve. I was looking at the statistics this morning, and there is only one country so far that has been, well, two, China and South Korea, that have had some success in flattening the curve. I believe for most of us, the South Korean model is the best one. But let me stop talking and hand it over to Ronnie to start to open the conversation as we look at the various pieces of legislation and the various measures being put in place, and then we'll go to Carmel. Ronnie?
Thank you very much, Nigel. I think you made the salient point, which is that while we are in a public health crisis, which in fact fuels an economic crisis, the overarching theme is that the response or the responses from the various Caribbean countries, and specifically Trinidad, Barbados, Guyana, and Jamaica, are all underpinned by legislation. And that means that, of course, we must have a functioning parliament, because in the absence of a functioning parliament, there cannot be any legislative changes, which really means that there is really no legality associated with various public policies. Perhaps and really I'm just summarizing them because they apply to throughout the Caribbean. The most important legislation, which I think affects all of us, is the Quarantine Act. And very little is known about this piece of legislation. It exists here in Trinidad, as well as in Jamaica, and I think as well in Barbados. But the effect of the Quarantine Act is that as we speak, our chief medical officer is more powerful than the Commission of Police or even the DPP. He's a self-effacing, very mild-mannered and soft-spoken individual, but he has enormous power.
Nigel, are you hearing Ronnie? Because I'm no longer hearing him.
I'm hearing him very clearly.
Is everybody else hearing me? Mm-hmm.
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. Yeah, I'm hearing.
Go ahead, Ronnie.
Oh, thanks so much. Yeah. Good. So I was just making the point that in Trinidad and Tobago, and I suspect in Jamaica as well, because they also have a quarantine authority, that the quarantine authority, because that's what that person is called, is perhaps the most critical and important person in our jurisprudence, because the quarantine authority has the power to direct the police to, in effect, to give effect to quarantine powers. Jamaica also has a quarantine authority, and my recollection is that unlike Trinidad, where that power reposes in a single individual, in Jamaica it is reposed, I believe, in the chair and four persons. The chair would be ordinarily the principal medical officer or the chief medical officer, and there are representatives of shipping and airways and perhaps business interests. But the powers are the same. They have the power to direct the constabulary and the police service. Now, it is equally important to understand, because many persons are in lockdown. We have had the expression social distancing, and some people are in effect speaking of it concurrently with the expressions curfews or states of emergencies. It is very important from a commercial point of view that we underscore that there are substantial differences between the operation of a quarantine authority and what in effect constitutes public order measures, as opposed to, for instance, a state of emergency. And the most important is that the latter, the state of emergency, constitutes an abrogation or surrendering of constitutional rights of the subjects who are affected by the state of emergency. We do not have a state of emergency, nor do I think it is contemplated. We may have a curfew, and that's a term of art, not of law. And the effect of it is that people are required to remain in their homes during a specific period in a specific geographical area. For me, as an attorney and persons who are interested in the legal measures, we want to ensure as far as possible that the constitutional rights of citizens are not surrendered or abrogated, even though we do accept that they are subject to the various public health and public order measures that are put in place. And I think we understand why it is important to maintain the constitutionality of all of these activities. In Guyana, and I think Robbie is with us, and Robbie can perhaps confirm this, Guyana has gone slightly differently. They have presidential orders, and the presidential order and direction, I believe it was issued on the 16th of March, limits constitutional rights, or has the power to limit constitutional rights. Barbados, which has amended its Emergency Management Act, also has put in place various public health ordinances, but not going as far as perhaps Trinidad and certainly not as far as Jamaica. The effect of all of these legislations is that we do have restrictions on the operations of businesses, and particularly bars, clubs, restaurants. We also have restrictions on the use of public spaces, for instance, beaches. We are told of perhaps further things to come, and I am expecting that ultimately there may well be legislative underpinnings for things like social distancing orders, which of course is remarkable in the scope of it, but there is nothing that prevents a social distancing order being made, which restricts a person to 5 feet or 6 feet from his colleague, or perhaps restricts crowds to no more than two persons. And that is permissible under the public health ordinances. It is also, of course, quite likely, and as these things ratchet up, that the enforcement mechanism will become more penal. So police officers are given much more discretion and are entitled to go way past what the law permits if they are directed by the public health officials to give effect to some of these orders. So I think certainly from a commercial or business context, we must be alive to the fact, firstly, that whatever measures are put in place must have a legislative underpinning. And if it does not, then it means that it's not enforceable. The second point I wanted to highlight is that we must do as best as we can and ensure that our decision makers understand the significance of removing or surrendering or abrogating constitutional rights and entitlements, notwithstanding that there are public health emergencies. It is really a last-ditch attempt. The third point is that we also must be aware that that as part of the public health regulations, that that the certain proclamations have been issued. And in preparing for this, I was interested to see that in Trinidad and Tobago, the president issued a proclamation since the 31st of January 2020, which meant, and that proclamation declared the 2019 novel coronavirus to be a dangerous infectious disease. And the significance of that is that since the 31st of January, the government was alive to the threat of the disease. And I'm thinking that we had Carnival and several other public events after. So, and I suspect the same thing happens throughout the Caribbean. So really, in summarizing, I want to also highlight that the quarantine authority is likely to have a much more vigorous and aggressive rule and in the enforcement mechanisms. And we can complain about perhaps the how aggressive some of it may become as the days progress. But equally, the balancing act that we are talking about, it requires the executive to be aware that they have certain obligations to citizens, notwithstanding the public health implications. That balance is likely to be the main point of focus, because tensions are going to be high. And I think that as leaders in business and other places, we have an obligation to have our voices heard, to warn the authorities that while they have very large powers, these powers are not uncircumscribed and they're not unfettered and must be exercised responsibly. And to ensure that it is exercised responsibly, we must put our heads above the cards and say that, and say it authoritatively and loud. I just wanted to perhaps end at that point, Nigel, because to allow others to offer views as well. I hope that's helpful.
Thank you. Thank you very much, Ronnie. And Lloyd, welcome to the conversation. I hope everything is okay in Jamaica. What Ronnie just went through were the kind of legislative instruments that have been put in place to basically help with activity that, or lack of activity, that would help to flatten the curve. And as Ronnie said, we need to be careful while being aggressive, in that we don't take actions that could adversely impact, I suppose, business and individual freedoms for the long term as opposed to the short term. So I'm going to turn it over to Carmel, and I don't know if you can help us to understand what's going on in Barbados and how the business community is working with the government to get us through this very, very treacherous situation. Carmel.
Thank you, Nigel, and good morning to you and fellow panelists. Right now in Barbados, we have 18 confirmed cases. Early on, the government, so in Barbados, we have something called a social partnership, which is a tripartite grouping of the private sector, labor in the form of the trade unions, and the government. And so early on in this crisis, government brought the social partnership together and set out what was going to be the preparedness plan for the nation. So right now we are aware that we are at stage two, because it was a four-stage plan. And stage two is where you have in-country human-to-human transmission. Now stage three, which is when it becomes extensive human-to-human transmission, is when they have signaled that they're going to initiate emergency powers. And as Ronnie mentioned, the Attorney General, these emergency powers are going to be expanded. They're going to Parliament tomorrow, actually, to expand these emergency powers to include dealing with health crises such as this. And what the business community has done in response to this is that many of our businesses have, those who are not necessarily client-facing or have to be client-facing each day, they've instituted remote working protocols. So for example, my office and many of my members have instituted protocols where their staff are now working remotely. This has been in an effort to enforce the social distancing of our own volition without having, you know, government having to respond with curfews, etc. And what we've seen happen in more of the client-facing businesses, such as the banks, the supermarkets, etc. So right now we are at, the government has imposed congregation of groups no larger than 25 persons. So that has meant that you've seen the supermarkets start to stagger entry of persons in. So basically you have to stand outside and there's security at the doors monitoring, you know, who goes in, who comes out, and letting in other people. What we've seen with the banks is that they have closed several of their branches, and they are, so they have, I guess the core branches open, the ones that are in the largest impact areas. And again, they are staggering who can come in and who can come out. But I guess in terms of mitigating the impact on their staff, they have chosen to close several branches across the island. So you're seeing, obviously, this means that there is now being a greater push towards digital transactions. They're really encouraging, so the banks, other financial institutions, et cetera, they're encouraging people to transact with them digitally. What's also happening is that you're seeing the business facilitation agencies, such as our corporate registry and or central bank, et cetera, also sending out notices to business people who have to deal with them to say that you can file your documents digitally, you can use their drop boxes, etc. So this is, it's having a knock-on effect in that the business community, you're seeing a lot less activity, but we're trying to do our part responsibly to respond to this crisis before it gets to the point where government has to institute emergency measures, and then you will really see a downturn in the economy. Because right now, it's the hotel industry and the knock-on services and industries that support it that are being the hardest hit right now. But then obviously you're going to see other, if there is a total shutdown, you're going to see other business communities equally hard hit. So that's my synopsis.
Thank you very much. We'll get into the discussion afterwards, but for me it's like hotels, restaurants, transport, taxi drivers, airlines, port workers, yep. All that kind of stuff. Those are the, and in the case of Barbados, and I lived there for 2 years, and I suspect some of my favorite restaurants are no longer open, or maybe open to delivery. But it's a problem that has to be dealt with, because the people who work in those industries are the more vulnerable of the population. So hopefully when we get into the conversation, we could talk to how boards are helping management to deal with that. So thank you very much. And Lloyd, over to you. How are things in Jamaica?
Morning, everyone. We are challenged in Jamaica, I think, very similarly to how all of our other neighbors and everyone else across the world is challenged.
Good morning, Lloyd. Is it possible for you to put on your camera, firstly?
I was trying to do that. I was having a bit of a challenge. I'm going to try it once more.
Yeah, just at the bottom where you're seeing the video.
Yeah, it's not coming up. And I had a similar problem on a call earlier this week. So.
All right, no problem. We hear you then.
It's telling me to select another video camera in the settings, and it's just not happening. I've been trying it for the last couple of minutes as well.
All right, don't worry. We can hear you clearly.
Okay, hopefully it will sort out as the call continues. Yes, so yesterday we confirmed our 26th case. I think as with many others, it's a question. There's always this question: are you testing enough? Right. So there are a number of protocols that we go through before somebody will go in to get tested. We continue to do testing. I think we're close to about 200 persons tested so far. From the governance perspective, so I mean, we have disaster risk orders that have been in place for many years. Our disaster management committee went into effect about 3 weeks ago. In fact, about 4 weeks ago, we had a meeting. The private sector had a special meeting with the Minister of Health and Wellness, as well as a separate meeting with our Ministry of Industry, Commerce, Agriculture and Fisheries. And it was very clear in both of those meetings, particularly meeting with the Ministry of Health, that there was a very defined plan that the government had laid out. I think most pundits will say that they are doing a decent job of both managing the situation, but as well as timely interventions, as well as communicating. They've done a very good job with communicating where things are, their plans and their expectations. In the meeting that we had about 4 weeks ago with the Minister of Health, there was some clear agreement in terms of communication and the role that the private sector would play in supporting, providing information and providing guidance. The Prime Minister announced a special advisory committee. So this is a committee that advises the disaster management, a special advisory committee that advises disaster management committee. Now, the disaster management committee is chaired by the Prime Minister, and it includes our own disaster and risk management, our version of FEMA here in Jamaica, as well as the police and everybody else who would be involved in mitigating or dealing with disasters. So this advisory committee is about six people. Two of those persons are drafted from the private sector. So other persons who are formerly presidents of the private sector organization or the Jamaica Chamber of Commerce. So we do have quite a bit of input, as well as we have had a series of meetings ongoing over an extended period with the Minister of Finance. And I'll come back to that in a short while. So where Jamaica currently is in terms of the things that are in place, we have closed off for all international incoming passengers. So international incoming was closed off. The announcement was made last week, Friday. The closure date was this Tuesday past for international incoming. However, we are still facilitating outgoing passengers. There are still some planes coming in, but those are under some very special circumstances they're coming in. And in most instances, it's either delivery of cargo or to provide an output for people who are currently on the island, in particular, tourists who are still on island who are just getting ready to go back to their respective countries. The disaster orders that are in effect at this point in time, there's a series of them. There's a requirement for anybody who can work from home, and I'll define it this way, anybody who can work from home should. So businesses have been given that mandate. However, people who are essential to keeping your business operating, should still go into work as would be normal. So because a lot of persons who are going and taking public passenger transportation, there's some specific orders put in place. So the public buses, as an example, you can only have people seated. The taxis have been all reduced. So if normally you could carry four, the maximum you can carry is three. And they've all been mandated to carry out specific protocols in terms of hygiene, safe distancing, in both in the vehicles and in public areas. All essential businesses, and when we say essential businesses, we speak about supermarkets, pharmacies, gas stations, an example, will remain open, and they continue to be considered essential businesses, so they'll remain open. And in those instances, the staff that they have are expected to come to work and continue to provide services for the public. There's a requirement in place that all bars, restaurants, and places of entertainment are closed. Not restaurants, all bars and places of entertainment are closed. Restaurants are to be closed and only be serving takeout. I think I've heard that in a couple of instances. It's very similar to that. Government workers over the age of 65 are to work. So they have been retired. We do have some persons who are on contract over 65. So those who are over 65 are to work from home. And as of Tuesday past, anybody who is over 75 years is to stay in place, to remain at home. So anybody who is over 75 should not be in the public thoroughfares or traveling around. They should remain at home. From the business perspective, the Minister of Finance, from a fiscal support perspective, the Minister of Finance on Tuesday announced a raft of measures aimed at supporting just about $25 billion in measures aimed at supporting the continued economic activity, and more than anything, supporting those who are going to be most distressed. So let's call it a social support program, if you will, aimed at the persons who are most vulnerable in society. A good amount of this $25 billion is around employers who continue to retain employees. So if you're retaining employees during this period, there is some fiscal support for you there, as well as any in-person who could prove that they were working up until March 10th, and they would have lost their job since March 10th. There's specific fiscal support for those individuals as well. There's one community in Jamaica that's been under curfew for about 2 weeks now. That's the curfew, that's the area where the first person, where the first person who contracted was somebody who brought it in from Europe, from London in particular, UK. They were in a particular community, and in the period they were in Jamaica, they were very much moving around in that community. That community has been is under curfew now, a lockdown curfew, and the government is providing support along with the army for the persons in that area until they've gone through the required quarantine period. I'd sort of leave it there. I mean, there are a number of other things I can add, but I think like everyone else, there's some specific steps that are being taken. Some of it is around how businesses ought to operate. Much of it is around how the public should be operating. As with everybody else at this juncture, it's primarily around flattening the curve. So we're very much focused on keeping people home, practicing social distancing, and protecting the more indigent in society.
Mm-hmm. Thank you very much, Lloyd. I'm not seeing Robbie's name. Is Robbie on?
Robbie? No, I really have been trying to get him. I'm not sure what the problem may be, but no, we haven't been able to get him online today.
All right. So the question I have is, okay, so if we focus on the measures that are being put in place to protect those that are very severely impacted by the social distancing measures. As we said, the indigent people that are employed in the affected industries and others who support. Many of the governments have announced the measures, the social relief measures, if you will. How are they delivering the support, and how and what processes and controls are being put in place to ensure that the relief gets to the people who need it without them having to jump through a lot of hoops? And I don't know if Carmel or Lloyd can speak to that. And I think Lloyd has dropped off. So Carmel, up to you. What's the mechanism to get us to get this stuff to where it's needed and needed quickly?
Okay, so I know the government has recently, they've issued NAS checks, sorry, not NAS, welfare checks early. Mm-hmm. And they have asked all businesses to honor the welfare checks, even though they're actually dated for this Friday, but they've already issued them. Mm-hmm. And they've told people that they can go to the post offices and cash them, or businesses, they're asking businesses to honor them. The other thing that they have done is that they have identified 600 vulnerable families, although the Prime Minister has said that she wants to push that to 1,500 or more if she can, with the assistance of the private sector. So what they've done is they've identified these vulnerable families, and they are going to be supporting them with direct monetary support. And then they've asked the private sector to also get on board. Still waiting to get more details about that, but I know they've set up a bank account through First Caribbean, and they are going, it's going to be, as I understand it, in a structured way where you are going to be matched with a particular family and asked to provide food, you know, clothing, monetary support, etc. I believe you can choose to help them through this difficult time. What we have also been asked as the private sector most recently is to also assist with the quarantine centers. in providing foodstuffs to people who are, you know, to support the people who are in quarantine. And so we have a Barbados Private Sector Association, of which BIBA is a member. And we started to, you know, rally our members within the individual business support organizations to come forward with donations. So several of my members have already purchased foodstuffs, not just foodstuffs, even sanitary napkins, et cetera, and donated them to the quarantine centers. So this is going on a rolling basis. So those are some of the measures that have been taken by government and the private sector. And then I know there are various service organizations such as Rotary, et cetera, that have also started drumming up support to be able to respond to families most affected by this downturn.
Okay, thank you. Lloyd?
So on this end, all the mechanisms for remitting the support or the aid that the government has promised is not in place as yet. Mm-hmm. In the announcement that was made on Tuesday, the Minister of Finance was very clear in terms of the aim is to use electronic modalities as much mm-hmm. as possible. So our eGov, which is the government's technology arm of the government, they're actually working with the tax administration department, various government agencies, to set up a portal. So for an example, if you've lost your job, you can just go online, identify who you are, your whether to your NIS or TRN number that would go in, you'd indicate how much you're paid and the employee you lost a job from. There'd be a mechanism for that employer to go online and validate that, yes, you worked for them, that you're no longer working for them. And that's how the government will remit the money to you. You'd have to put in a bank account because the intention mm-hmm. is for all of this to be done electronically. Mm-hmm. Very similarly, the supports to the private sector will be electronic. So again, they know who we are as corporations. They would have the information in terms of the number of employees we filed for in our last filing, and depending on the information that they request, they'll know, okay, you're now 10 employees less, 10 employees in this particular wage category, salary category, and on that basis, we will remit a certain amount of funds to you to cover a certain amount of funds to that employee mm-hmm. or for you to support the employees that you retain. So those are the mechanisms. They're almost all electronic. They were pretty well advanced up to the update I got yesterday. I think the intention is by next week, they should have these things in place. So a number of these measures, he did indicate the date of implementation as being April 1. So they do have a few more days to put all of this, the mechanisms in place. I think if I follow on what Carmel, she was mentioning some of the other things that are taking place. So on the side of the private sector, there have been quite a bit of support in terms of providing funds to acquire beds, bringing in additional masks to help our health system. And these are ICU beds, right? So full ventilator kits and everything else. So whilst the government is putting some money up, the private sector is also providing some funds to support. J. Ray and Nephew, the makers of our very famous J. Ray and Nephew white rum, which is absolutely the best rum in the Caribbean. I'm not asking for anybody else to comment. I just had to put in that plug, but let me step back. I mean, they've done a great job. They provided 100,000 gallons of pure alcohol for making sanitizer. So they've provided that. I think 50% went to our National Health Fund. A certain percentage went to our health agency, to the Ministry of Health for distribution. And a certain amount will be distributed in other humanitarian modes, you know, through service clubs and so on. So there's that kind of support. So there's both fiscal. What we are also doing with Food for the Poor, which has done a tremendous job of supporting persons who are less able to care for themselves economically. The a number of private sector agencies have increased their support to Food for the Poor, both in terms of cash and kind. And those funds, as they go into Food for the Poor, Food for the Poor is using it to continue to provide support in social support as they have been doing in the past.
Okay, thank you very much. The question that has come to mind for me is, and it starts with charity begins at home. So two questions, and anybody on the call can jump in. What measures are being put in place to retain employees, albeit at reduced compensation as we work through this? And two, are boards or members of boards in contact with management to kind of look at alternative scenarios going forward? What does this mean for the operation for the next 6 months, assuming this lasts for 6 months? And given our mandate as board members to act in the best interest of the companies that we direct, what does this mean for the kinds of activities that we're going to be looking at going forward? And let me say this, I believe that as board members, we should be acting in the long-term best interest as opposed to the short-term best interest of companies. So what kinds of conversations are we having with management as we look at various scenarios going forward?
I just want to share, Ronnie, before you answer. I think Claire also has a question. So,
all right.
Yeah.
But I think she had directed the question to Ronnie. Ronnie, go ahead.
My overarching point is that while we do have, and there's no shortage of policies, I really feel that we are deficient in terms of, there seems to be an absence of a central coordinating agency. In other words, and we use the question of the salaries or the honoraria to keep people at their workstations. It seems to me that while the policymakers are making the policies, we are not right behind them, should be an army of persons who comprise the central coordinating agency. And I'll give you an example. For instance, in terms of getting monies to persons who are going to be disadvantaged, we really should have a team comprising persons from the Ministry of Finance, the National Insurance Board, the Board of Inland Revenue, because they have the data to be able to get monies to persons fairly quickly. All of this is in the context that currently public servants are not at their desks, generally speaking, or not likely to be at their desks in the foreseeable future. Even though there are a lot of people who are working remotely, there are very few field officers who might be able to venture outside. And therefore, we need to put some mechanisms in place to ensure that the various promises which are made by the government get to the persons on the ground. And I'm very concerned about the absence of those mechanisms. And that is also in the context of groups which are humanitarian or philanthropic, for instance, you know, of Rotary, you know, of Sir Optimism, many other groups. And in the absence of a central coordinating agency, perhaps the Ministry of Social Development or the competing ministries throughout can say, well, look, we are taking responsibility for getting your monies or your donations or whatever it is, come and drop it off here or something like that. It was done in Haiti, it was done for various other events. Just on your point in terms of the role of the board, I think the board's obligation is to ensure, and perhaps its overwhelming obligation is to ensure business continuity. That is its business. And in order to ensure business continuity, we must, and the sustainability of the business, we must ensure that our loyal and valued employees are retained. So our obligation now is very simple. We need to make sure that they are there, firstly, perhaps remotely or elsewhere, but that we have a business to come back to. And therefore, we should be providing support, not just looking to the government agencies, but now interest rates are so low, it's an excellent time to borrow. We can leverage whatever strategic partnerships we have. We really need, as a board, or as boards, to be very progressive in how we think and how we do, and to ensure and communicate this to our employees. We are looking after your interest, because of course, your interests are integral to ours as investors. I just see that that should be the overwhelming mandate. Thanks.
Nigel, this is, and everyone, this is Lloyd. I just want to pick up on where Ronnie left off. One of the things that I know many of our boards here in Jamaica have been really pressing on the executive management team is the importance of communicating during this time. So the number of companies, there's so much uncertainty. The tourism industry contributes somewhere in the region of 35 to 40% of our GDP. So with the literal closing down of the hotel industry, many hotels are closing, sending home staff. The question on everybody's mind, as an example, is what happens to me? So some organizations, and we have been working with the Human Resource Management Association of Jamaica to speak to employers about some options that are on the table. So, the extent to which you can financially support it and you have employees going on vacation leave, maybe you might want to have them take some vacation leave, you cover some costs. Real clarity around how is sick leave used in this period. If you're not sick, you can't take sick leave, as an example. But it's around staying true to the processes and the governance constructs, but providing some flexibility in supporting your employees, as certainly where a number of the conversations are taking place. And in almost every instance, as I speak to board members, they speak about their business continuity plans. We worked along with our Ministry of Industry, Commerce, Agriculture and Fisheries to deliver a document which is essentially a business continuity guide for MSMEs. And that has been very well received. Because as a small business, I don't have the resources. I don't think in that way. So a document was developed. We have been, both ourselves and other private sector support organizations have been disseminating this to MSMEs to help business leaders, because they may not in all these instances have a fulsome board to understand the things that they should be thinking around business continuity. Another useful document that has been developed by the private sector is a couple of our private sector groups came together and provided what we call some industry sector guidance. So by industry sector, we said, here's how you probably should be operating your business. This is what you should think about doing. Business process outsourcing organizations should be doing these things, and we ask the government to support them in this way. So the engagement and information that gets into the hands of both business leaders as well as the boards, we've tried to ramp that up, and in so doing, provide them with information mm-hmm. that will help them to make better business decisions in the immediate term.
Lloyd, that is excellent. Would you mind sharing that with us? I don't know if you can share it through Kamala, but it's something that
I don't envision a problem. I look at some of the documents we have and happy to share.
Okay, great. I see Robbie is on. Robbie, how are you?
Hey, morning. Sorry to joining late.
No worries. Better late than never. So What's can you update us to what measures are being put in place in Guyana in respect of enforcing social distancing, and also what relief measures are being put in place for the people who have been affected, or the industries and team members and employees who have been affected by social distancing in terms of losing jobs and that kind of stuff?
First, let me start. It's this COVID-19 caught us in the midst of an election crisis.
Yep.
So when our first case was actually made known to us, when the ministry indicated that we had our first known case, many thought that it was part of the political gimmicks. Because what had happened, the ballot boxes that were the containers that were storing the ballot boxes, they were 40-foot containers at different strategic locations where the ballot boxes were being stored. They were actual citizens who were guarding those containers. They were being on the roadside and as close as possible they can get in to guard the integrity of those containers because they were feared that they would have been compromised. So people thought that this whole thing about COVID-19 was an act to get them off the street and to have them desist from gathering. It is, I didn't play as a former healthcare worker. We work at the main hospital in Guyana for 13 years. And I have been the co-chair of a disaster relief committee in 2005, and we had a major flood, and then we had an outbreak of leptospirosis. I didn't pay much emphasis in this whole thing until some of my colleagues started to reach out to me to highlight some of the challenges that they were facing. For example, our hospitals are ill-equipped to deal with it, not only from a human resource nor a facilities perspective, but they are so deficient where supplies is concerned. I think we are the worst prepared in the Caribbean. Yesterday I had so after people started reaching out to me, I start calling some other former colleagues. And what they indicated to me, it's very, very saddening and pathetic here. First of all, I reach out to a very senior doctor and I ask him, what are the guidelines that the hospital puts out for the staff and for the public, or if there were any that were disseminated to the public, because I haven't seen any. He said there is none. Then I told him I was receiving calls from from different departments that indicated that there was no supplies. Procurement said that, procurement people said that they are now trying to get up stuff like gowns and gloves and different stuff, but it's unavailable. And when I highlighted that to several of the doctors, they said supporting the fact. I went to the government pathologist yesterday to find out what happened with the first case, the first death that we had. And he said to me in my amusement that this person is still in the mortuary. Now, I think the WHO guidelines clearly state a death should be buried in the soonest possible time. And we are going into maybe 3 weeks now with the body still there. I read the news last night that there were some, matter of fact, this morning I read the news, there were some Guyanese who were stranded in Barbados. And I suppose there had to be some rich person among them who were able to lobby the government of Guyana and to charter a plane to go for all who were there. And the government, in the interest or for mercy, they granted it, but under some conditions. Now, when those people came home, they are refusing to adhere to the guidelines that they had initially agreed to for isolation and so forth. I look at some of the spots that they have used for isolation. For example, the first death, the immediate family of four, all four are housed in one room. So I don't find that very in keeping with the guidelines. And these four persons have no symptoms, but they were all test positive. And there are some other nine individuals who are there. I happened to see this morning as well on Facebook that there are photographs sharing of the isolation room where there is actual bunk beds and a fan with nothing else, you know, no proper running water. So I think we are here, it's ill-prepared. I was told yesterday as well that the first meeting was actually called after the first death, the first the preparedness meeting. So apparently the health, all of this may have happened due to the fact that we have the election crisis, and people were more focused on that, and not so much on preparing for this pandemic. It is to say that we had our first case about 3 weeks ago, and they are still reporting to us that we have 4 others who are positive. And there are 9 who are in the 9 that are in our extended family who may have come in contact with a person, but they have no signs and they are not positive, but they were just there. But when you compare that to Trinidad, who had the first after us, and there, I think your number is about 50 now. So it makes me wonder how accurate are our numbers taken into consideration that we are ill prepared. From what I heard from some friends in Trinidad, you guys have things sort of in place somewhat as well, but if you have so much more control and mechanisms in place and following established procedure than us, and we are only 4, it makes me wonder. People on the streets, I see there are calls for a total shutdown, because I can think majority of the persons are not adhering to it. I can see bars are still open. There are different things that are going on. Obviously, all the containers for the ballot boxes have moved to a central location, and there are lots of people, I assume, about 100 plus every night congregates to guard it. Some of which are saying that guarding the democracy is more important than coronavirus. So I think Guyana is between a rock and a hard place. The last thing I heard that we had 25 test kits and they had exhausted those, and we don't have any more, and some others supposed to be here. I saw PAHO made a distribution of 100 PPE, disposable PPE that is, which I will find very inadequate, because I don't know who they intend to use the PPE, if it's a staff at the hospital. Obviously, a shift has more than 100. So what happened when you dispose of that? So in terms of supply, in terms of systems and procedures and protocol and guideline, in my humble opinion, Guyana is not prepared. It is on Facebook going around in the social media and in the newspaper that we prepared by one, closing the zoo, and secondly, they had some jingle, some song they bring out about COVID. I haven't listened to it about COVID-19. So it seems that those are our two biggest measures we put in place.
Understand the concern, and I understand the distraction of the very fluid electoral situation. But what can responsible governance practitioners do in this situation to get the political directorate of whatever side they're on to do the right thing? How do we get home to them the seriousness of the situation?
I think the political directors have acknowledged the seriousness. I would wish to say that for the record, that they acknowledge the seriousness in this. But in terms of preparing, noting that there are no flights coming in and out of Guyana, they haven't identified a proper isolation center, makes things very challenging. When I was at Georgetown Hospital, I was the director of financial responsibility for procurement. And I used to say, and in my office, I had a sign that procurement is the heart of the hospital. You could have the best doctor and the best nurse, but if you don't have the resources, it's counterproductive. So in this case here, we may have what it, we don't have what it takes to provide for the people. So in the typical situation that we are in our political crisis, and for example, I one of the find too is that we don't have any ministers right now by law. The only thing is a president. Once an election has happened, the only post that remains is a president. I noticed that the minister of health is the former minister of health is trying to take a lead role or comes out to the public. I think how burn in this election political health.
You're breaking up a lot, Robbie.
Different. I the internet at the office has been horrible for the last week or so. Yeah, it's been horrible here. Yesterday I had a good session because I was at home. I just had to run the meeting today, so that's why I end up at the office.
If I may just add, Nigel, so we do have a few comments from the chat I wanted to share from KSQ. Robbie, your concerns are valid for Guyana. So this person is advising your staff, your family members, and those in your circle of influence to take all precautions as this is a critical situation. Also, we had a contribution from Rowan Braffett who said he thinks it is very important in order to ensure sustainability to communicate with empathy and honesty. Customers remember your actions as well as your messaging in times of crisis, and it could affect your continuity. So profits and bottom line cannot be the most important thing at this time. I just also want to remind, there was a question from Claire earlier, and that was for Ronnie to deal with the Quarantine Act in Trinidad and Tobago. And her question basically was whether the act is sufficient to get everyone to self-isolate, or is it that we may have to resort to a state of emergency in Trinidad and Tobago? So I leave it now to you, Nigel.
Thank you. Ronnie, you want to take that last thing from Claire?
Yeah, thanks, Nigel, and of course, Claire. The short answer is no. The existing Quarantine Act does not permit us to legislate against legislate for social distancing. And that requires, right now it's a voluntary exercise. In order for it to be mandated and to be enforced and implemented, it has to be part of the public health measures that are taken or will be taken. And it's not difficult. The language can be done very quickly. But unless and until it is issued by Parliament as part of the whole suite of legislation, then there's really no basis for enforcement of the social distancing and certainly for curfew. And I just want to repeat the point. A curfew is not a term of law, it is a term of art. There is no curfew unless, of course, it is consistent with a state of emergency. And of course, the state of emergency has not, nor do I think it is proper to have that called. So right now, at its highest, we can probably encourage legislation in due course for social distancing, perhaps to the 2-3 feet, and also, of course, to restrict persons externally to no more than 2 together rather than any more than that. So I hope that answers the question.
Thank you very much, Ronnie. We are out of time, and I just want to wrap up, and I want to thank Carmel, Ronnie, Lloyd, and Robbie for their inputs. What I would say is, Robbie, I don't know if you heard, but Lloyd and the business community working with the government in Jamaica, and Carmel, the business community working with the government in Barbados, have come up with material that we can use, and Lloyd is going to share this with us. So for me, in the case of Guyana, you need to get people focused not on the politics but on the people and how you navigate this very, very serious situation going forward. I would also add, I was thinking this morning that so far the response to this crisis has been almost national. Each country is looking out for itself and its citizens. And I was wondering, where are the global organizations? Where is the United Nations and all of those? And is the response, should the response really be a national one or should it be a global one? Having said that, I understand the limitations of a global response at this time, given the governance, that governance is basically a national concern. So I want to thank everyone. Lloyd, I'm looking forward to you sharing whatever you can share with us as we continue to work together and learn from each other as we navigate this very, very serious crisis. So thank you all very much. I'll just put it back to Kamla to wrap up. And take good care of yourselves, please. Kamla.
Yes, thank you. Thank you very much, Nigel. We're getting a little feedback from someone. I'm not sure who it is. Just to make sure our microphones are muted, please. But this is just me saying thank you all very much. I thought this was really an excellent session as well. We will try to keep it as a weekly session. So certainly I'll try to get some more participants and panels together because I thought this was so excellent. I have learned so much. You know, I want to commend Kamel and Lloyd, especially for taking the time to gather their information to come and share with us in terms of how their government and their business sector have collaborated, mm-hmm. and therefore how that is impacting the way we move forward with this. It's really tremendous. So thank you all very much, and I look forward to everyone joining us again next week, Thursday, 10 a.m. to 11 a.m. for our next response to COVID-19.
All right. Take care, everyone.
Kamala, thank you, Nigel. Bye, everybody.
You're welcome. Bye-bye.
Bye.